with issue for all women.
Hello there, Mickey here. For this week's Sunday Chops, we handed the reins over to journalist Hazel Davis. She got on the phone to Dr. Kat Arney to talk about Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution and the Science of Life. Kat's book about the big bug in the system of life and how we get cancer, because we can't not get it. They also chat cancer and COVID-19 and what's happening there, learning cancer's secrets, Tasmanian devils, Maud Sly and thousands and thousands and thousands of mice. A heads up that Hazel clearly has ants in her pants and is a bit of a wriggler, which is the background noise you'll occasionally hear. Hopefully, it won't distract you from the fascinating facts Kat is throwing out. Over to Hazel and Kat.
My name's Hazel Davis. I'm talking to Dr. Kat Arney, author of Rebel Cell, Cancer Evolution and the Science of Life. She's also host of the brilliant Genetics Unzipped podcast for the Genetics Society and fronts loads of BBC Radio 4 science documentaries. So, hi, Dr. Arney.
Hello, you can call me Kat. Please call me Kat.
Can I? How exciting. I like to show deference. You know, there's no other way to go into this. Cancer's a bastard and COVID's a bastard, and the two are combining with presumably horrific results. It's not a good time to have a cancer diagnosis or treatment. How badly are cancer patients being affected by the pandemic?
It's incredibly worrying. Here in the UK, we're starting to look at the data that's coming out, and you can see that there has been a really big drop in the number of people getting tested for cancer, getting a new diagnosis of cancer during this time. And you'd be like, yay, does that mean cancer's gone away? No, it doesn't. Wow. I think this was some research done by people at UCL, and they figured that it's potentially tens of thousands of people maybe losing their lives this year as a result of delayed diagnosis or delayed treatment for cancer. And it's incredibly concerning. So we've got people who maybe weren't able to go and get symptoms checked out, maybe were too worried at the time when things were very, very bad to get stuff checked out. They had their treatments delayed. And I think there are some quite bad knock-on effects. And you add onto that the impact of the crisis on things like the funding for cancer charities, cancer services, care, and all this kind of stuff. And it's not a great picture. And now I'm just bringing out a book about it. I don't think anyone really wants to think about
but it does feel like it's the last thing we're thinking about. It's the media generally, isn't it? It feels like all everyone can think about is COVID, and we're not thinking about any other problems or diseases or health issues bar that, really. So great time to bring a book.
I know, I just want to put a disclaimer on everything and say, like, other diseases are available. You know, there are still other infectious diseases. You still need vaccinations for all these things. You still need to get stuff checked out and try and get appointments.
At the risk of derailing this, what can people do if they want to get a cancer diagnosis? Just to do what they would have done before and hope for the best, really?
Exactly. I mean, it's still, if you have any worrying symptoms, it's always the advice. If something's not normal for you, if something doesn't seem right, you've got to go along and get along to your GP. And now the doctor's surgeries are open, you are able to get appointments. I think there's going to be a very big backlog. But, you know, certainly someone close to me is going and getting checked out and getting scans. Stuff is starting to move through, and I think hopefully we won't see too much of an impact, but there is potentially going to be quite a big one coming down the line. Basically, if something's not right, always the rule is get it checked out. But obviously when things were really difficult, that wasn't always possible.
Your book is a kind of history of cancer and what we know about it and how we have come to treat it and that kind of thing. And it's really brilliant. And it's, aimed precisely at people like me who don't really understand or haven't previously understood what cancer is. Can you give us a kind of a run through of what is cancer? If you can do that in a handy soundbite.
Just in a nutshell, yeah. So that's an interesting question that actually during writing the book, I came to question myself, because I spent 12 years working at Cancer Research UK in the science comms team. And so we got asked, like, well, what is cancer? A lot of the time. And you'd sit down and you'd start typing this sentence that we all knew. And it was, cancer starts when a cell picks up mutations in its genes or sort of changes in its genetic program and multiplies out of control. And we just all sat and typed this, and I never really sat and thought, well, is this actually the full story? Is this really true? And that's one of the things I really wanted to dig into in the book, is like, what exactly is cancer and where does it come from? And like, when is something a cancer? Like, what is the difference from cells that have just gone a little bit sad or a little bit rogue to becoming this disease that is aggressive and invading through the body? And so that sort of picture of like, oh, well, it's just cells that have gone wrong and are growing because they've got mutations, genetic changes, that's actually really overly simplistic. And I'm moving towards this idea that basically cancer cells, cancer is, it's a fundamental biological process. That's an important thing to know. It's not something that we've, you know, that has come visited upon us. It starts from within our own body when our cells go out of control. And, you know, it's not something that comes from outside. But it's actually, it happens when cells cheat. They rebel against the rules of the society that they're in. And that's something I go into in quite a lot of detail, that, like, our cells in our bodies, and it's a nice way to think about yourself, you're a society of cells where all the cells are doing the jobs they're meant to do. They're not making too much mess. They're not taking more than they need. They're making new cells where they're needed, and old cells are dying when they're old and damaged. And, you know, this is the society that keeps our bodies healthy. And cancer cells arise as cheats. And in fact, when you start looking across all of life, you see cheats arising in societies, and they cause problems for the societies that they're in. And in the body, that leads to cancer. And in other societies, that leads to, you know, things like in bees, you get sort of colony collapses due to cheating bees. And that really helped me to embed this in the grand sweep of life, I suppose. Like almost all branches of the tree of life, every animal you can think of probably gets cancer. There's only a couple of notable exceptions. And it goes back through deep, deep time. Just this week, perfect timing for the book, they found a 77-million-year-old dinosaur fossil with a tumour. There's a 240-million-year-old fossilised turtle with a tumour in it. And, you know, ancient human remains, the more we look for signs of cancer, the more we find it. So this is just like, this is an ancient disease that affects life. It's not just a modern human disease, although there are things we do that don't really help ourselves.
There's a kind of general perception that if we smoke, if we drink, if we don't lead healthy lifestyles, then we're going to increase our chances of getting cancer. And that's what makes it feel like it's a very modern thing, that we've brought cancer upon ourselves by being modern humans. So that's not true then, or partially true.
It's one of these things, it's like, it's complicated. So there are definitely things that we can see in our lives that we do that increase the risk of cancer. So the most obvious one is cigarette smoking. You can just look at the rates of lung cancers and other types of cancer in people who smoke and people who don't smoke, and they're much, much higher in people who smoke. So we know clearly smoking, things like, you know, lots and lots of exposure to ultraviolet light, lots of exposure to x-rays, nasty chemicals, all these kind of things, they do damage our DNA. They add to that sort of fuel for cells to go rogue with, because cancer cells do have genetic changes. They are messed up inside. But what makes these kind of messed up cells? We discovered that, and this is something really blew my mind, by a certain age, you know, by middle age, so much of your cells are kind of genetically messed up. They're all a bit sad, but very, very few of them will ever go bad. So you have to think, well, there's something else going on. There's something that's actually keeping the society of our cells and our tissues running. And that's where you want to think about, well, what does keep a body healthy? We only think about what goes wrong when we get sick. We don't think about what keeps us healthy, what keeps all our cells in check and functioning together, and what helps to sort of suppress these cheating cells. And that may well be things like, you know, the boring stuff like exercise and eating healthily and controlling inflammation in the body and getting enough sleep and all this kind of stuff that we know keeps us healthy, but we don't really know why. So I think there's some very, very interesting connections there.
Yeah, you do say in the book that we focus too long on what is cancer rather than what is not cancer. And I think that's a really interesting thing. So what are the things that aren't cancerous cells? Let's look more about non-cancerous cells rather than cancerous cells.
Yeah, exactly. So this is work from the researchers at the Wellcome Sanger Institute. And they started looking at tiny, tiny, tiny patches of normal tissue. So normal skin, normal esophagus, the tube that connects your mouth to your stomach, normal uterus, the womb, the endometrium, and like what looks like absolutely normal tissue, no signs of cancer, it's nothing's gone wrong with it, nothing looks wrong with it, it's just riddled with mutations. This was wild, and I think people don't appreciate that. We sort of knew it, yes, of course, as we get older our cells pick up mutations, but seeing the extent and finding that a lot of those changes, if we found them in a cancer, we would say that is the genetic change that's driving this cancer.
Yeah.
And we find it in normal cells. And the researcher who did this work, I sort of went to see him and he peered into my face. And I'm in my 40s now, so, you know, things are going south. But he sort of peered in my face and was like, "Your skin is a patchwork of mutation." And oh my God.
Oh, no.
But amazingly, out of all of that, we're all, you know, kind of mutated all over. But most of us will only get one or maybe two cancers in our entire lifetime. That's an incredibly narrow chance. Cancer is incredibly rare on an individual level, but it is incredibly common in the population. You know, one in two people at some point will get cancer in their lifetime. Personally, it's a rare event in terms of your cells, but it's a common event. It, like, at some point it does happen.
Because that's a kind of fatalistic way of looking at it, isn't it? We're all going to get cancer at some point, or we've probably all got cancer anyway, so why bother treating it? That can kind of, isn't there a sort of risk that we go down that route if we start thinking about it like this?
And well, not at all, because I think that there's a few things, if we really understand, like, what is cancer and when is cancer and how better to look for it. We know that we can cure cancer if you find it early enough. There's an old surgeon's mantra, you know, nothing heals like cold steel. So once a tumour has started growing, if you could detect it, and if it is genuinely going to grow into an aggressive cancer, and we don't really know the difference at the moment in many cases, but you can remove it with surgery and that is gone. The real problem is when cancer has spread through the body. So we need to think there are some really exciting new approaches for treatment there. But I think also the book really shouldn't be like a call to just, oh, just give up, you know, get the fags, get the booze, just give up on it. Because actually it shows that prevention, by keeping your tissues healthy and by controlling these cheating cells, if we can understand how that works, and we can push the development of cancer back another sort of 10, 15 years, because cancer development is a slow process. It takes years for a sort of group of rogue cells to grow into a tumour. If we can push that back, you know, by the time that you would develop a cancer, you're like 95, then that starts to be a really, you know, a good innings for now, certainly. And it's really pushing away the risk of cancer that starts really rising in your 60s and 70s, because that's when your risk of cancer does start rising. And, you know, in our modern lives, that's getting into the prime of life, you know. Kids are out, you're starting to retire, go and enjoy yourself. So I think trying to push that boundary of when our cells do sort of start to get knackered, I think that really could be helpful. So it's not a call to just give up, don't bother treating anything. It's a call to think more cleverly about what we're actually up against.
You talk about the sort of main intellectual breakthroughs in cancer treatment, and particularly because this is standard issue and we love women, we're particularly interested in Maud Sly. Tell me about her and her big ideas, or ideas, because so, she was really cool.
Maud Sly was a very, very interesting woman, and she was a researcher. She was living in sort of the early part of the 20th century in Chicago. And she was one of the first people to really get interested in the question about how heritable is cancer. So cancer does seem to run in families. And we now know that in certain families, there are genetic changes that could be passed down the generations that increase the chances of certain types of cancer. So a really obvious one is the BRCA genes, the breast cancer genes, or the Angelina Jolie gene, if you like. So we know that there are genetic changes that kind of set your cells further down the road to cancer. And Maud was one of the first people to really think about this. And she set about trying to prove this by breeding thousands and thousands of mice. And this was at a time when women couldn't really get access to their own funding or their own lab. She didn't have money for a technician. She spent her whole time just dealing with thousands of mice herself. A very lovely woman came to help her, and Maud was like, "I can't pay you." She was like, "Oh, it's fine. I'm posh. I have my own money. I'll just help you because this is interesting." And she did start to show that cancers that arose in a family of mice, they could be inherited. So that was really interesting, but a lot of people ignored her. And at the same time, there was a researcher called Aldred Warthin who worked with a seamstress called Pauline Gross, another woman who's sort of overlooked in the history of cancer, who had many, many cancers in her family. And we now know that they were affected by a syndrome called Lynch syndrome, which increases the risk of bowel cancers and womb cancers due to a genetic change. But, you know, this being the kind of the 20s and 30s, people like Maud and people like Warthin, they were very into eugenics. And they were all like, well, if all these bad things are inherited, then let's just get rid of the families with the bad things. And and so the whole history of genetics is just tinged with these people who took it all too far. And so I think a lot of that work about the patterns of heredity in cancers got overlooked for a long time. And also it was just quite hard to figure out. We didn't really know, like, what are genes and where are they and how do we find them? So to find these faulty genes didn't really start happening until the 80s. And so now you can offer people genetic screening and testing and you can sort of get all sorts of preventative options for families. But, you know, that all started, I think, with Maud Sly and all her mice.
And prior to that time, we thought cancer was catching, did we? We thought it was something that could be kind of passed on.
Yeah, the views about what is cancer and how do you get it have really changed. So, you know, obviously in the very old times, there's the idea it's visited on you by an angry god, or it's something that you've done wrong. It's your sins. And modern day, we can sort of say, your lack of wellness and your toxic environment that has visited this upon you. And then certainly in the early part, again, of the 20th century, a researcher called Shope, he discovered that there was a virus in rabbits that caused them to grow these like sort of horny growths. And he was like, this is a cancer virus. And he discovered this virus that induced cancers. And then a few more people, Peyton Rouse, he discovered that there was a virus that caused tumours in chickens. And so through the 50s and 60s, everyone was obsessed with the idea that cancer is caused by viruses. Like, let's just find the viruses and we get rid of the viruses and then that's it. And the problem is that in humans, that doesn't really work. There's a few viruses that we know actually cause cancer in humans. There's a few more infectious agents that significantly increase the risk. They sort of make cells go rogue. And things like human papillomavirus. And actually, one in five cancers worldwide is linked to an infectious virus or bacteria. And we could do a lot better there in controlling it. But everyone was obsessed with this idea that it was a virus and you could catch it. And that turned out not to be the case. But I think it really, again, it really misled people. But actually, so here's, do you want to know the stories about the cancers that you can catch? These
are
kind of some wild ones. So these aren't human cancers. So as far as we know, there are no contagious human cancers. You can't catch cancer from someone. Although in the book, there are a few sort of experimental situations that I do talk about where that's happened. And it's wild. But yeah, there are some contagious cancers. So the best known example is Tasmanian devils. So they live in Tasmania in southern Australia. They're very cute, actually. But they, my God, they hate each other. So when they meet, two devils meet and they will just bite each other's faces. In the 80s, researchers discovered that these devils were developing terrible facial tumours, so big, like, tumours in their jaws that were killing them. And it was looking like it was starting to wipe out the species. And they discovered, you know, mostly every cancer that starts in a body, it's a one-off event. It starts from the body and it ends in the body. You know, either way, it ends in the same body. But they discovered that all the cancers in all the devils were the same. So it was the cancer cells being transmitted when these devils were fighting and biting. It was the first example of a transmissible cancer.
Does that not mean it's not cancer, though, if it's transmittable? I mean, I'm not an oncologist, clearly, but does that not stop it from being a cancer, then, if it's transmittable?
Well, no, so it's like the ultimate leap of cancer. So writing the book, I've really understood cancer as this, like, ongoing evolutionary process. And every innovation of life we see in cancer, and it's almost like the ultimate metastasis, the ultimate migration. You know, if the body that you're in is dying, you go to another one. So you spread outside the body. And these are definitely cancers. And we found another one in dogs. There's a dog genital tumour that is transmissible. And there are clam cancers. Clams, various shellfish, shed cancer cells into the sea and other clams pick them up. I think the more we look for these, the more we find. But
yeah, of course,
I will say there's, at the moment, I don't think there is any chance that humans will be able to, like, swap cancer cells between them, because our immune systems are very effective at picking up what's us and what's not us. So if you get cancer cells from someone else, it very quickly they will be destroyed.
Our body would go, what? Yeah. What is that?
Exactly.
Without taking this down a horrible, depressing rabbit hole, what's the research around COVID and cancer, and is there much being done, or are we not there yet?
So at the moment, most of the research that's being done is just looking at the kind of the impact on diagnosis and the impact on treatment and, you know, people who have delayed diagnosis. And in the UK, like I said, I think that the impact is going to be quite significant. There could be thousands of people who lose their lives over the coming years as a result of a late diagnosis or delays in their treatment. And, you know, I think that is the sort of the hidden side of it. Really, everyone is so focused on COVID and forgetting that there are many other people who their disease does not stop. So I think that's very difficult. There's a second question about what is the interaction between the virus and cancer. And I think that hasn't really been looked into very much.
Because, we're looking at the impact of the virus on our bodies and long-term neurological problems and things like that. So that obviously makes one wonder that what the impact that will have on cancers that we get, or how will it mutate into... Oh, God.
Exactly. But there could be a positive side. I was talking to one researcher, because we know that in some cases the immune system can be very powerful in fighting against tumours. And that's the point of these new immunotherapy drugs. They sort of wake up the immune system. But unfortunately, they don't work in everyone. And there's a lot we don't really understand about why or why not. But potentially, because COVID is a disease that really does seem to like distress the immune system or really wake it up and make it go for it, could that actually potentially be beneficial? You know, could killing cancer cells be a side effect? Now, we do not know this at all.
Wow.
And certainly it's going to be a tricky question. We'll only really start to see that in the data as it comes through over the months and the years ahead. But I think that is an interesting question. I mean, it's also hard, you know, particularly writing about a disease like cancer, which is just an absolute terrible bastard of a disease, and COVID as well, which is difficult. But the science behind it... It's really interesting.
It is really interesting. Rod, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you. Tell us where we can find you. Give us another plug for the book and where we can buy it. And it's out. When is it out? Today?
So tomorrow? Today is pub date. Yeah, today is the 6th of August. It comes out today. There's all the links to buy it from rebelcellbook.com. I'm selling little signed book plates as well, because I'm just really gutted that I can't be going out and doing talks. Yeah. As you can guess, I just love talking about this, so I'm very sad I can't be
Luckily
out and about
us.
But yeah, rebelcellbook.com, and you can find me on Twitter. I'm at @Kat_Arney, KatArney, and I'd just really love people to engage with the ideas, see what they think, talk to me about it. Yeah, it's, I think, this new way of looking at a disease that is very scary and very old, and hopefully, you know, we can have more of a healthy respect and some ideas about how to go forward.
Thank you so much for your time. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Standard Issue, for all women.